We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay, starting out with the city attorney's office has released a report this week.
Yeah, the city attorney's office released their second quarter report on cases referred for prosecution. They are required, the city council passed a bill requiring the city attorney's office to make quarterly reports to them on crime in Seattle and how their criminal division is handling cases. Overall, in the report, the city attorney's criminal division under the new city attorney, Ann Davison, is referring about the same percentage of cases for prosecution as the former city attorney Pete Holmes did. So about half of all cases. So not a big change there. Interestingly, her office declined to prosecute about the same percentage. So the number that they referred and the number that they declined have not changed very much. Now, there were a few significant differences. One is that Davison's department has sped up the review and referral process, dropping it from a median of 79 days under Holmes down to just 3 days under Davison. So you might look at that and go, wow, you know, is the city attorney's office actually doing a good review of and finding the types of cases that warrant prosecution and that the city attorneys feel can actually benefit from going to prosecution and cases that they think they can win versus cases where they don't have enough evidence or the charges might not have been appropriate or something. And we'll have to see in the coming quarters how the prosecution rate fares under Davison now that it's just taking only 3 days for them to review cases. Also in the report, the number of quote, criminal, non-traffic, non-domestic violence referrals is increasing every quarter under Davison. So these types of cases involve things like theft, trespassing, harassment, and assault cases that don't involve domestic violence and weapons charges. So many of these cases represent crimes of poverty, especially the theft and trespassing cases. So many more of those are getting referred for prosecution under Davison than they did under Holmes. When it comes to the list of 100 high utilizers that Ann Davison insisted on making, that list of people who she termed frequent flyers through the system, those 100 and I should point out many of those folks are also homeless. 82% of the cases that involve a high utilizer were referred for prosecution, and only 18% were declined. So making that list of 100 names really allowed Davison to single out those 100 individuals and come down on them hard. So that's something we should be aware is going on. Now, in spite of her overall tough on crime campaign rhetoric, Davison is using diversion programs at a much higher rate than Pete Holmes did in any year prior to the pandemic. And that includes community court, mental health court, and pre-filing diversion programs like the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, or LEAD program, which is run by the Public Defender Association. And the report also includes, and this is kind of interesting, so Davison and her supporters who like to badmouth these diversion programs and say, you know, that's being soft on crime, and yet here she is, she's using them a lot more than Pete Davison, or that Pete Holmes did, sorry. when he was in office. So I think that's kind of interesting. Now, the report also includes a heat map showing where most of the crimes happen in the city. Okay. The overwhelming majority were in the downtown core, including South Lake Union and the Broadway Pike Pine corridors on Capitol Hill, with a small hot spot in Northgate and another small one in the Rainier Valley. Now, the heat map on the following pages is further broken down by council district. District 2, which has the Rainier Valley hotspot in it, has a high number of assault cases, then domestic violence cases, and then theft cases in that order. District 3, which is the Capitol Hill area, has a high number of assault cases and domestic violence cases. And kind of interestingly, the map legend doesn't specify how many of those assault cases might be hate crimes. I kind of wish that it did, considering that District 3 has Capitol Hill and the hotspot there is the Broadway Pike Pine corridor. District 5, which has the Northgate hotspot, also has a high number of assault cases, domestic violence cases, and theft cases in that order. And then finally, in District 7, which has the downtown core in South Lake Union, it has a high number of assault cases, theft cases, and domestic violence cases. And one quarter of all theft cases in Seattle are in District 7. That's higher than anywhere else in the city. And I'm sure that includes a lot of retail theft. Okay. Now, District 7 and District 3 combined, that's downtown to First Hill, Capitol Hill area, they share about half of all assault cases in the city. And the highest percentage of domestic violence cases are in District 2, that's Southeast Seattle, followed by District 3, which borders District 2. Again, that shows the impact of poverty and the pandemic lockdown on families and the kind of stress that it puts on them. What I find the most interesting about this heat map is not so much the districts I'm talking about, it's that the neighborhoods with relatively low crime that are in places like District 4 and District 6 are often the most vocal about crime and about hiring more police and supporting the police in Seattle. So I find that kind of interesting about the report.
Hmm. Apparently, a lot of those people are afraid to leave their district.
I guess. I can tell you a lot of those people are not leaving their district. We all know that most folks are not commuting to their jobs anymore. They're working from home, particularly people in high-paying office jobs have the luxury to work from home. But nevertheless, they still have a perception that crime is high, even though the bulk of them are living in low-crime neighborhoods.
Well, 'cause that's what they're reading in the news.
I guess. Yeah, I guess.
Or seeing on
I should point out, too, that the city attorney's office doesn't prosecute a lot of violent crime. They deal with shots fired incidents, but not incidents in which someone is murdered, for example. That's a higher court. It's not the municipal court that handles that. Municipal court handles lower level cases like simple assault, like muggings, retail theft, domestic violence cases, DUIs, things like that.
And that's why, you know, Davison's campaign last year, which is primarily based on fighting violent crime, was mm-hmm. so disingenuous because the King County prosecutor handles that.
Exactly. Hmm. So that wraps up the quarterly report.
All right. Well, yeah, I agree. It's interesting that her Davison's use of diversion programs appears to be taking part of the secret sauce of her
predecessor.
Of her opponent too. Mm-hmm. That, you know, was heavily emphasizing diversion programs and not prosecuting.
I wonder how much of that is due to city staff that she inherited, because she oversees, I think, a couple hundred employees. And she didn't, you know, only the most senior positions are political appointees.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's also the fact that if all those cases went to the municipal court would be swamped.
Yeah, but that's not her problem.
So, well, it is a little bit her problem.
Sure, I know. I'm joking.
Because that backfires on her. So I'm sure she's just utilizing whatever tools, you know, the criminal division is utilizing whatever tools are available there to move cases along. And because the municipal court, again, a lot of people are not returning to work, and municipal court had a big backlog of cases already from the COVID pandemic, it's pretty swamped. So, you know, to move things along, they're utilizing these resources that were in place for diversion programs at higher rates now than Holmes was.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to city council related news.
Yeah, so a lot going on in the city council this week. On Tuesday, the full city council passed Council Bill 120389 to approve the hiring incentives for the Seattle Police Department. Now, the bill was initially requested by Mayor Bruce Harrell, but the final bill contained some amendments that were added on Tuesday at the last minute. The one amendment included the wording that any officers hired before the bill takes effect will not be eligible for an additional bonus. The amendments also included officers who leave the department, then come back within a 2-year window won't qualify for the bonus, but they will be able to pick up where they left off in terms of their salary and benefits accruals. So for example, if an officer recently left the department or leaves in the next few months and then decides 2 or 3 months later, I'll just come back because there's a signing bonus I could get, that person's not going to be eligible for the signing bonus. Now the council the amendments also said that the council will evaluate periodically whether the program is actually working. So it looks to me like they're going to reserve the right to rescind it if it's not actually having any effect on Seattle Police Department hiring. And
you know,
then,
like all the bonuses in the past happened.
Like all the studies have shown in the past. And then language was added for the program to expire in December 2024. Okay. So it's going to be in effect for the remainder of this year and then for the next 2-year budget cycle. But the city council would have to pass another law to renew it after December 2024. And as an incentive to get new hires to stay, if an officer leaves within 5 years, they will have to give back the hiring bonus. Okay. So it's got incentives built in so that officers can't just kind of job shop and go, well, I'll get a bonus at the city of Seattle, then I'll go to Kent and get a bonus there, you know, and then a few months or a year later, I'll go to Renton or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the money to pay for the 2022 bonuses, Lisa Herbold mentioned this, the money to pay for the 2022 bonuses is already in the Seattle Police Department budget. So there's no need to find any additional funding anywhere else in the city budget. It's going to be allocated from existing salary savings. But of course, to fund 2023 and 2024 bonuses, the council is going to have to look around for that kind of money, or they're going to have to do a big reevaluation of what the SPD salary budget should be. Now, the overall vote, it passed 6-3 with Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, and Shama Sawant voting no. Mosqueda pointed out that hiring bonuses don't really affect the working conditions of police officers who can't provide the kind of human services like shelter or mental health treatment for the very many person down calls that they have to address. She also said that there's no real proof that hiring bonuses work. And she cited several studies, including some of the city's own studies and data on previous hiring bonus programs. And she also quoted the SPD's own statements that, you know, most officers who join the force, they don't join to get a hiring bonus. Now, she also pointed out that hiring bonuses can make existing officers feel underappreciated and affect overall employee morale. And, you know, I'm sure that officers in the Seattle Police Department know that the city has a limited amount of funds for their salaries and for these programs. So, yeah, I kind of agree with her on that. Tammy Morales also agreed with Mosqueda, and she urged the city council to spend money on things that are the root causes of violence. She said that the city really needs to build healthier communities, including providing high-quality, affordable housing, good-paying jobs, capital for new entrepreneurs in underserved communities to start businesses, youth mentorships, after-school programs, and school nurses, and affordable health care and mental health care. She pointed out that SPD's overtime budget alone is higher than most city departments, and that it has become a backdoor for increasing the SPD's overall budget.
Shama's the need for bonuses.
Yeah, right. Shama Sawant also said that the city should be putting money towards reducing inequality in Seattle, reallocating SPD funding and taxes on big business towards funding public schools, childcare, affordable housing, tiny house villages to shelter the homeless immediately, for parks and for things like public restrooms. She called for a democratically elected community oversight board for the police with subpoena powers and the ability to hire and fire police. And she also pointed out that the Seattle Police Officers Guild has not yet agreed to a new contract with even a minimum of oversight. And that
SPOG, I was going to mention that, yes.
Yeah, and that SPOG was evicted from the King County Labor Council. She reminded them all of that, which I thought were pretty pointed and pretty good comments to make on this bill. Now, Andrew Lewis did say he was going to vote for it, but he mentioned that all democratic societies have a police force of some kind to enforce the law and deal with violent crime. It's a necessity. It's what he said. But he once again wished that the city council were making more progress on implementing a new civilian public safety program and that the council had set aside funds for this purpose over the last 2 years. But where's the program? Right. And he's the one who suggested at least a pilot program based on what other cities are doing. And he's been probably the most vocal person about that. Of late. Now, Sarah Nelson then jumped in and cited a letter from Harriet Walden calling for the hiring of more SPD officers. And I want to point out that Harriet Walden, who started out as the head of Mothers Against Police Harassment, has also for many years now been the head of the Community Police Commission, which is part of the now dysfunctional oversight system of the Seattle Police here in Seattle. And there are many folks who are kind of scratching their heads at Harriet Walden's shift towards
she's
supporting police.
She's a respected elder in the community, but she's really changed her tune quite dramatically the last few years.
Yeah. Nelson also said that hiring more officers would, quote unquote, save lives and, quote, reduce the number of people shot and killed on our streets, end quote, which kind of shows you how tone deaf she is to concerns of the folks living in communities of color in the city of Seattle. She also talked about improving the conditions of work for SPD officers, but made no mention of any civilian public safety system at all to take the lower priority calls from them, which kind of shows you that she can parrot what the other city council members are saying, but I don't think she really grasps the meaning often of what they're saying. Then, of course, Council President Deborah Juarez stepped in to kind of summarize the pro-police bonus bill. She called this bill a step in the right direction and called it an example of, quote, good policy and good common sense, end quote. And that, and this is another direct quote, an understanding of who we are as a city makes change, not slogans, end quote. And that really was her slap at the everyday march and the Black Lives Matter protesters who called for defunding police. And she's been hostile to them right from the start. And then, of course, she went on to give a little lecture about politeness, which I found extremely patronizing. Mm-hmm. And then Lisa Herbold was the last to speak about the bill. She wrapped up by summarizing what the bill would and wouldn't do, and saying that being a first responder is a difficult job and the city should not make it an impossible job by not hiring enough officers to respond to priority 911, high priority 911 calls. She also brought up the city's requirements to maintain police staffing under the consent decree, which is true. And that the mayor's office was actually moving forward now on drafting a bill to shift some low priority 911 calls to civilian responders. The council just had to be patient about that because, although Jenny Durkan's administration deeply resisted that move, Mayor Harrell's office is not resisting. They're actually moving forward on it now. And she expects them to have a bill later, sometime later this year. Now, one of the call-in commenters, I should mention, during the public comments was TK from the Everyday March, who said that the council, she kind of came out with her disappointment and said, you know, the council really lied to Black Lives Matter organizers and is not really serious about community alternatives to policing. And, you know, protests might start again.
Yeah.
That was kind of the gist of what she said. And
that's about the only leverage they have, honestly.
Yeah, honestly. And they might need to if Mayor Harrell's office is just paying lip service to the council when they say that they're interested in shifting low priority 911 calls to a new civilian team, and they don't actually come up with a bill in a reasonable amount of time. That might be the card in the back pocket that Seattle needs to play in order to get this moving.
Yep.
So that wraps up that.
Yeah, that might be the card in the back pocket for many of the progressive directions we need to take.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, on Wednesday morning, the Finance and Housing Committee passed three bills related to to cannabis equity to address the lack of Black-owned businesses in the cannabis industry in Seattle, given that that communities of color have been on the kind of on the butt end of the war on drugs. But then the committee also heard a presentation on the updated August economic and revenue forecast prepared by the new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts and the City Budget Office. Excuse me. The main takeaways of that new August revenue projection is that inflation is eating into local economic growth. Inflation is 10.1% in Seattle versus 9.1% nationally. But employment growth remains strong, particularly in the IT industry, in trade, and in the professional and business services industries. But of course, the leisure and hospitality and manufacturing industries are still lagging. So that's still pulling holding the local economy back. National forecasts of a potential recession, we've been hearing some of those lately. Those have increased the risk that a recession could occur locally. But July's baseline forecast from last month is still pretty good, given that inflation slowed in July and national employment overall is looking pretty good. Okay. With growing inflation comes growing B&O tax and sales tax revenue, which shouldn't surprise anybody, right? The higher value of purchasing goods and services means that there's more income that businesses have that is taxable by the city, and there's more money that people are paying when they purchase items means higher sales taxes, tax revenue for the city. So the estimated revenue for 2022 is expected by the end of the year to be $33 million over what the city had hoped to collect for 2022. So that's the good news for this year. However, for next year, the baseline forecast for 2023 revenue is expected to be about $140 million under what will be needed to cover the city's expenses for 2023. That's the shortfall that the mayor and city council will have to deal with in October when they draft the next 2-year budget. Now, that revenue shortfall, you might be scratching your head going, you know, how are we $33 million over what we expected to have in the budget for this year, but we're going to be $140 million under next year? That difference relates to the federal and state COVID grants that the city, primarily to those grants that the city expected, that the city received this year and are spending on priorities to try to help the local economy and to help people who are struggling under the pandemic. Those grants are not expected to be there next year. So that is that's going to make up most of the hole in the budget. Now, also, we're going to have to look at what the expense columns are going to look like in the budget because of inflation. There could be an even bigger gap once we take into account the cost of paying people wages and buying supplies for the city governments to operate. That could increase the expense side of the city budget next year quite a bit. So we'll see what the mayor proposes. He expects to release his budget the third or fourth week of September, and then the city council will roll up their sleeves and start digging into the details and making changes. They usually pass a final budget in the week before Thanksgiving, so usually towards the end of November.
Okay.
And then on Wednesday afternoon, the Public Assets and Homelessness Committee met. That's chaired by Andrew Lewis. They heard a presentation on the current progress within the King County Regional Homelessness Authority to ramp up action on homelessness. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority has been hiring and getting their services underway and making these occasional reports to the city council, because the vast majority of their funding, about 70% of their funding, comes from the city of Seattle. So they were making a summertime, their kind of mid-year update to the city council. Some of their progress, and the presentation was made by Mark Dones, who is the head of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Some of their progress includes things like emergency housing vouchers. The lease rate for those is 67%, with about 80% of them issued. And that's really good progress on getting those emergency housing vouchers out and getting them used to get people into housing. It's much, much higher than national rates or rates in other cities. They've consolidated contracts from 300 down to around 220. The city Human Services Department used to have 300 separate contracts for housing and homelessness related services, but a lot of those were multiple contracts with the same providers. Dones and his agency have been working to try to consolidate a lot of those. So instead of a provider having three or four contracts, they now just have one. The agency has also hired 17 peer navigators, which they're now calling system advocates. Which is a little confusing, because the city council still thinks of them as peer navigators and city council members still call them that.
You know, the homelessness industrial complex loves euphemisms and fancy titles.
Yeah. They have 10 more that they're in the process of hiring, so they will have 27 peer navigators pretty soon. And those folks are now being deployed out to the streets. They've collected 500 plus oral histories as part of the point in time count that they did earlier this year. And those are currently being analyzed to figure out where shelter gaps are. Currently, that appears to be emergency housing and permanent supportive housing. So pretty much what we knew already. But they're going to try to estimate exactly how many units are needed with what specific mix of services. The question there was, what services do people really need for supportive housing? Do they need more mental health? Do they need more addiction recovery services? Do they just need basic help in getting their ID documents reestablished? Do they need job training, et cetera, et cetera? They're trying to get a good sense of what mix of services are needed for people to get them housed and housed successfully so they don't end up back on the street. They're still working on a by name list, and they expect to have a completed list for the downtown core by the end of August or early September. But that, I should point out, that's just a small chunk of the total homelessness population in Seattle. That's going to be a while, take them a while, I think, to get a by name list. And there's going to be, I think, a significant chunk of the homeless population who are going to resist giving that kind of information.
Yeah, I'd imagine that would take them a couple of years.
Yeah, yeah. Now, as part of the agency's five-year planning, they're doing a bunch of different data analysis things sometimes I was looking at some of that thinking, God, a lot of this seems like busy work. We kind of know what people need. Why are we going, jumping through all these hoops? I think in a way it's sort of a requirement of the Herald administration that they do as much data collection and analysis as possible. Also, as part of their five-year planning, the agency has been holding stakeholder events to get input from, you know, stakeholders, and they've held around 50 of them so far, which was kind of a surprise to me because I've not heard any of these meetings publicized. Doan said that these events have been listed on their website so anyone can attend, but I have to say they haven't been well publicized. So perhaps folks who are part of the homelessness shelter and services provider network may know about them, but I don't know that members of the community know about them. Now, they also said that they've contracted with Lehigh, which was the only applicant, to run the new safe lot for RVs, which will serve approximately 35 vehicles and a total of 50 people. And there was discussion about that later in the meeting. I'll talk about that here in a minute. In the recent heat spell in July, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority was able to coordinate cooling at City Hall. They put up cooling canopies in three locations, and then they stood up a couple of more spaces to help a total of about 680 homeless people, which Doan's thought was a really successful response. But I have to say, I don't think that was a great response considering the thousands of homeless folks in Seattle.
Yeah, what is there in King County? Something like 12,000?
Yeah,
I mean, we haven't had a good point in time survey for a couple of years now, but that was where it left off, I believe.
Yeah. But then Doan's went on to say that they learned a lot and built a tight relationship with Public Health Seattle and King County and other providers. So I guess that's why they think that was a success. I don't know. The agency says that they have a way to submit written suggestions for how to redesign how they deliver services. And now is the time, Mark Doan said, and I think we should take that opportunity to give them feedback on how their services are being provided.
Yes.
And yeah. And then they said that they kind of wrapped up by saying that they're currently seeking more state and local grants, and that they've brought in about $60 million in total from the federal government and from the state government. Andrew Lewis then asked about the peer navigators downtown. What's the timeline and what will they be doing? Doan's replied that they were out today. And he showed a photo, and they showed a photo of them in white T-shirts with purple sleeves and the King County Regional Homelessness Authority logo on them. So you might see them if you're downtown. Their main task right now is finishing the by name list and going to places where no one has gone to count people and take oral histories, like Yesler Terrace and near the stadiums. And I kind of scratched my head at that. It's like, wait a minute, you mean you did it? Your last point in time count, you didn't go to Yesler Terrace?
That makes no sense.
Yeah, I know. So I don't know. Maybe I didn't understand what they were saying. But anyway, so then Doan said that they would eventually be connecting with people and ushering them into the shelter system. Lisa Herbold then asked about the RV safe lot, which she shepherded the funding for in the 2022 budget. She wanted to know what happens in December 2022 if the safe lot is not up and running yet and all of the funds spent. Doan's responded that they're finalizing the startup budget, then figuring out what the monthly budget would be, and then they're hoping to come back to budget chair Mosqueda with those estimates and get the okay for spending through the end of the year and make a request for 2023. This will also give them an estimate in case the city council doesn't fund it next year, and then they can go to King County and ask for the funds or get a grant somewhere else. But it remains a priority for the agency to fund it. It's currently about $1.9 million, and Herbold said that she really wants to see that money to start to get spent this year so that she can make an argument that it's helping and needs to continue when they do the budget in September and October. Doan said that they're hoping to finalize the estimates within a week, but I really kind of felt like there was pressure, that the city council was trying to put pressure on them to get that up and running, and the money's been there since the start of the year. Why isn't it running yet? So kind of made me think that maybe things are not real functional at the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. I also have to say that when I watched the presentation, I didn't find Doan's to be a terribly mature in his presentation. I kind of felt like maybe I don't know, maybe they were not a super effective leader. So I think the city council might be having some concerns in that regard as well.
Yeah, if you noticed it, I'm sure some of the more perceptive council members, which is to say everyone except Ann Nelson, probably did too.
Sarah Nelson. Yeah, Mosqueda asked him if the agency is spending its full budget. Doan said that they were about 15% under budget on spending. They're still having trouble getting enough folks to hire is part of the reason given. And that includes the providers that keep telling Doan's that they are having trouble hiring as well. So we'll see. But I think the city council might be reconsidering the budget for the regional homelessness agency. I know there's been some turnover there, rapid turnover at the agency, where they've hired people and then those people have left just a few months later. So that could be indicative of problems at the top. So so on Friday in the Sustainability and Renters Rights Committee, which is chaired by Shama Sawant, Resolution 32064 to ban gas-powered leaf blowers in Seattle passed on a vote in the committee of 4-0, with Sawant, Lewis, Morales, and Nelson voting for it. Notably, 40 jurisdictions within the U.S. have already banned gas-powered leaf blowers. For example, Washington, D.C. bans their sale and use, and the state of California has passed a ban on the sale of all gas-powered lawn and garden equipment that's set to take effect in 2024. So Resolution 32064 would phase out use by the city and its contractors by January 2025 and would require Seattle residents and businesses to phase out gas-powered leaf blowers by January 2027. Currently, the city owns a little more than 400 of these things throughout its various departments, like the Parks Department, the Department of Transportation, et cetera. And they're not just a noise nuisance, I should say. They also produce toxic emissions that affect the workers who use them, who are often people of color. And they produce greenhouse gas emissions. And there are plenty of electric options available for leaf blowers or for other lawn and garden equipment. So the council is set to take its summer recess over the next 2 weeks, so there won't be any city council meetings from August 22nd through Labor Day. That's Monday, September 5th. So next week I'll be talking about something else besides the city council.
Well, I want to know when the gas-powered leaf blowers take their break.
I do, too. I have to say that every time
They're trying to unionize.
There you go.
The leaf blowers, right.
Protect their jobs, yeah.
So I have to say, every time I walk by somebody who's using one of those things, I always get something in my eye. Mm. You know, I hate them. They always use them on a dry day.
And they're serious noise pollution. They really
Oh,
are.
Yeah. Yeah,
in addition to the, you know, fossil fuel connection.
Yeah, and they're often being used early in the morning when people are trying to sleep. That makes them a noise nuisance. But I also just feel like they kick up a lot of dust just to make the sidewalk pretty, and they produce a lot of toxic emissions.
Yeah, and then half the time they're just used to blow the leaves on the sidewalk out into the street.
So, yeah, rather than collecting
yeah.
them.
Exactly.
Yeah. True. What is the point of that? And with,
yeah.
with cars passing by just blowing the leaves back on the sidewalk. Yeah. So also this week, the King County Sheriff's Office is investigating Jenny Durkin and Carmen Best's missing text messages. That's some good news there. King County Prosecuting Attorney Dan Satterberg asked the King County Sheriff's Office to step in and open an investigation into former Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin's and former Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best's missing text messages from the summer of 2020 during the George Floyd protests and the establishment of the CHOP Zone on Capitol Hill. This is after the current mayor of Seattle, Bruce Harrell, and City Attorney Ann Davison have both refused to order an investigation. And then the Washington State Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, said that he really doesn't have jurisdiction to investigate. It's a local matter, and local authorities need to investigate. Satterberg said that he had heard from many community members who were disturbed by the lack of concern around the destruction of public documents, which is a felony under Washington state law. Durkin claimed that she damaged her cell phone and was issued a new one, but that someone else in her office set her new phone to automatically delete text messages, which I find highly improbable.
How does that explain that several other senior managers, including former police chief Carmen Best, also
yes.
had their text deleted from the same time period? Were they
yeah.
were they all victimized by the same improbable accidents?
Yeah. Now, Carmen Best has admitted, she's admitted earlier this year that she was in the habit of routinely erasing text messages from her city-issued work phone, which, again, is a violation of state law. And the city of Seattle has already spent about $400,000 to try and reconstruct the missing text messages. But as you just said, Jav, it appears that there were lots of other folks in both Durkin's office and at the Seattle Police Department who deleted their text messages, too, from that time period. Not from any other time period, but just from that time period.
Yeah,
so I think investigation.
Which was the critical uh-huh. period when the George Floyd protests were the largest and the conflicts with SPD were the largest.
Yeah.
So in addition to the actual deletion of texts being illegal, it kind of smacks of conspiracy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think an investigation is going to uncover a coordinated attempt to cover up the details behind how the city responded to the George Floyd protests and the CHOP zone. I think there was probably mismanagement there. There were a lot of back and forth, you know, that the mayor didn't want anybody to see, and that Police Chief Best didn't want anybody to see. And so there was a coordinated attempt to just erase that from the public record.
I think we're also going to find out that the decision to abandon the East Precinct, which is what led to CHOP and Chaz, that, you know, the city threw the on-site commander for SPD under the bus and said it was strictly his decision and Best and Durkin were not involved. I think we're going to find out that was a complete fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
Very
so.
Likely. Yeah.
So that's in the works. So that's some really good news.
It's interesting that another thing that doesn't get mentioned with Satterberg pursuing this now is the mm-hmm. fact that he's departing at the end of the year.
I know. So whether that continues and the King County prosecuting attorney, the new one who takes office at the beginning of next year. So if that person decides not to file charges, Satterberg doesn't have to worry about it because he's not in office anymore. But that could definitely happen. So voters vote for in November for King County prosecuting attorney is going to make a big difference on whether this case gets pursued. I think whether charges are filed.
And we will return to that theme again in the next couple months.
There's a good chance. There's a good chance we'll return to that.
Yes. 8 Paul says it is likely.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Let's move on. Starbucks.
Yes. This is not a local story, but it is a local company. And it fits a theme of large local companies, Amazon, tend to be very hostile toward unionization efforts. This was a local judge in Tennessee ordered Starbucks to reinstate 7 workers that it had fired. Basically, they alleged in their lawsuit because of their union organizing activity. Now, Memphis, the particular location in Memphis, was one of the first Starbucks outlets in the country to unionize. And it came despite Starbucks spending a prodigious amount of money to try and convince their workers not to unionize. They did anyway. And now we've seen several locations in Seattle, for instance, follow suit. But this is an interesting precedent, and it reminds us once again that Starbucks is relentlessly anti-union in their hiring practices and firing practices.
Moving on to this week's pandemic-related news.
Yeah, King County has declared a public health emergency over monkeypox. This follows the Biden administration declaring a similar federal public health emergency last week. Locally, most of the transmission of monkeypox so far has been among gay males having sex. So, you know, it's not something where we've seen a lot of community spread the way we did early on with COVID. It has a very different epidemiological profile than COVID did. But, you know, as we've seen also with the vaccine rollout for monkeypox, it seems like our political and public health leaders have learned almost nothing from the COVID pandemic. We're seeing long delays in availability to try and get the monkeypox vaccine. You're seeing, obviously a different profile of people getting the vaccine also, because unlike COVID, elderly people are really not that vulnerable to monkeypox. So, the vaccines are currently available at local hospitals and I think some pharmacies. If you are in an at-risk category, you should consider that. COVID, of course, still continues, and the numbers have been really pretty flat for the last couple, 3 months in terms of local infections. But the COVID pandemic is still with us. And, the fact that our country seems to have collective amnesia about that, as though a million people didn't just die, is mind-blowing to me. But we've talked about that before, so I won't belabor the point.
Yeah, there's much about the people within our borders that is mind-blowing to me.
Yes. Yeah, the epidemic, the rapidly spreading epidemic of stupid has no vaccine at the moment. It's discouraging. And we're seeing that in a lot of the Republican nominees for different state offices in November, too.
I get a little impatient hearing people say, oh, I'm sick with COVID and it's terrible. It's terrible. And they complain about how terrible it is to be sick with it and how bad their symptoms are. And I just get kind of impatient with that, with a feeling of, well, why'd you go out without a mask? Why'd you go to that? That concert, not wear a mask, partying with your friends?
I can't possibly figure out where I got it. And you ask a few questions and realize that they can't figure it out because they expose themselves in so many different ways, without wearing a mask, without practicing social distancing, any of that.
So. Yeah, well, and then, you know, they complain about, oh, it's so painful, and, oh, you know, I was sick as a dog, and I'm like, well, yeah. You know, that's why yes. we've been isolating for two and a half years, because, you know, this disease, think about how sick you would have gotten if you hadn't been vaccinated. You know, yep. you probably would have been one of those people in the hospital.
Yeah, or on a ventilator.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in an induced coma so they can.
Yeah. So just a reminder to folks, just because you're vaccinated and maybe also boosted doesn't mean you can't get it, and doesn't mean you can't get really sick and have it be really painful.
Yeah.
And maybe end up with long COVID.
And if you have not been boosted, and the latest numbers show only about maybe 30% have had two boosters.
Yeah.
20% have had two boosters, excuse me. 30% have had at least one. But it really requires at least one booster to protect you from Omicron and all of its subvariants, which are the dominant versions now circulating. So if you haven't gotten boosted, please do so right away.
Yeah. And even then, if you get sick, you could get very sick. Maybe yes. not end up in the hospital on a ventilator, but let me tell you, it's no picnic to be really, really sick like that and maybe be sick for long term if you have long COVID.
And, you know, anecdotes are like the opposite of epidemiology, but I would say that the number of people who have been using home testing kits and then not reporting their positive results means that the numbers of infections I suspect are very, very low. Just anecdotally from the number of people I've personally known who've gotten sick in the last couple of months. It seems to be much
more.
But
the official numbers are artificially low.
Way.
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah.
I would probably agree with that.
So anyway, keep social distancing, get boosted if you haven't. If you haven't gotten a vaccine, for God's sakes, I don't know why, but please do so. And protect yourself, protect your neighbors and family and friends.
All right. Somebody's got a big jet landing near them. There's something.
I think that's my air conditioner.
probably.
Okay.
I'm not turning it off.
The air conditioner. Okay.
I could make it worse by turning mine on.
Yeah.
But all right. I thought I would wait till after the show.
Yeah, that's probably.
Because I'm considerate.
Well, you're not having hot flashes.
That's true. And if I was, I would be really concerned.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on. Got a few minutes left here. Cheney losing in Wyoming.
Yeah, and that got a lot of attention earlier this week, of course, the Tuesday primaries in Alaska and in Wyoming. And we saw, Lisa Murkowski and Sarah Palin both advanced in their respective races in Alaska. But Liz Cheney got blown out in Wyoming. She got blown out by a Trump-endorsed MAGAite name, I believe Maggie Hageman, that is kind of nuts, honestly, as you would expect. And, of course, is completely bought into the big lie and, think Trump walks on water. So the final result was something like, 67% to 29%, which is a really depressing description of how completely Trump has taken over the Republican base. Now, mind you, Wyoming is a very rural and very red state, so it's not necessarily indicative of how the rest of the country is feeling, but certainly rural voters and older white voters, Wyoming is generally a pretty white state, really, really adore Trump. And to the point where, the state of the Republican Party as the conservative alternative in the United States, that's really no longer operative because the Republican Party has no ideology other than what Trump's ego demands. You know, it's completely ideology free, except maybe owning the libs. Maybe that's an ideology. But it was kind of a depressing result. Now, Cheney is talking about potentially running for president, which would be presumably the Republican nomination for president. She's still a very conservative legislator. She's just been sounding the alarm on Trump's threat to the democratic process. She really, I don't know where she would get the funding, and I don't know where she would get the votes to be a factor in the Republican race for the 2024 nomination. Certainly there are a lot of Republicans positioning themselves for that race just in case Trump is made unavailable by the legal system. We'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, we haven't heard the last from her for sure, and she's definitely still on the January 6th committee as a vice chair until January, until her term expires. So we will see more from her. And we're also expecting to hear more from the January 6th committee next month when Congress is back in session.
All right. Any Trump-related useful news this week?
There was quite a bit of news this week, some of which was actually useful. Alan Weisselberg, who was the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, pleaded guilty to 15 felonies in a settlement with federal prosecutors. And agreed to testify against the Trump Organization in an upcoming civil suit. So, and there are, I believe, there are also criminal charges. So that was a major win for federal prosecutors. They've been trying to get Weisselberg to flip for months, and he basically knows where all the bodies are buried, metaphorically and probably literally.
I think what's really important about Weisselberg is he not only knows all of the inside information on the Trump Organization, he was also Donald Trump's personal tax person. So he knows a lot of the ins and outs of his personal tax situation. So that could be very, very interesting for prosecutors who want to get Trump and the Trump Organization on charges of tax fraud.
Yeah, and Weisselberg had worked for Trump's father, so he's not a young man. And the sentence he's going to receive as part of his plea deal is relatively light, but the testimony that he can offer is invaluable because obviously he has decades of history with the Trump Organization.
Yeah, that would seem to be a golden person to talk to.
Yes. And in other Trump crime family news this week, both Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal attorney, have been called to testify before a grand jury in Fulton County, Georgia. That is the grand jury that started out investigating, you know, Trump's "Find Me 11,800 Votes" infamous phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State. But that probe seems to be expanding to include a lot of people in Trump's inner circle as well. And the entire elaborate, you know, the fake elector scheme and a lot of the other conspiracy around Trump trying to overturn the election, at least in the state of Georgia. So we don't necessarily know what the scope of their investigation is because, of course, grand jury proceedings are not public. But the Fulton County prosecutor has been very aggressive in subpoenaing people to appear before the grand jury, and it's starting to cut into Trump's inner circle now as well. So keep your eye on that investigation. It's less high profile than some of the federal investigations into Trump, but I think if we're going to see an indictment of Trump, that may be where it comes first.
Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time. But there's always next week.
That's true.
Yes, there is.
And we will be back to spread good cheer all next week.
All right. Well, we'll prepare the good cheer floodgates for then.
Yes. Totally.